Welcome back to our second installment of NEST podcast on equity, diversity, and inclusion within school psychology. I am Shayla Desai, the NESP Director of Educational Practice. My pronouns are she, her, and I'm honored to be the host of this series. This episode will focus on welcoming, affirming, and inclusive schools and the role of school psychologists in creating these environments. Today, I will be joined by guests Kathy Mollig, Sam Mollig, and Amy Canova, who will introduce themselves in just a moment. Specifically, we're going to be discussing Sam's experiences as a student with intersecting identities and Kathy's experiences as a parent helping their child get needed support. Amy will help us understand the related implications for school psychology practitioners, especially as it relates to the intersection of gender identity, sexual orientation, and disability. With that, I'd like to welcome our guests, Kathy, Sam, and Amy, and ask each of you to briefly share your pronouns, your current role, and any other information about yourself that you think is important to share. Kathy, do you want to start?
Sure. Thanks for having us. We're very happy to be here. My name is Kathy Mollig. She, her are my pronouns. I am the founder and executive director of Trans Family Support Services, and I am the super proud parent of Sam. So we adopted Sam when he was 2 months old. He was born 13 weeks premature to a homeless alcoholic. So he pretty much has had care for his disability from day one.
Thank you. And Sam, do you want to go ahead next?
Sure. My name is Sam. My pronouns are he, him, his. I'm 20 years old. I'm currently a college student at Palomar Community College. I identify as a gay transgender man, and I believe that my role to play in the work that I do is to speak out for youth who may not be ready or to have the voice to speak up just yet.
Thank you. That's incredible. Go ahead, Amy.
Hi, my name is Amy Canova. I am a school psychology practitioner working in majority high school settings. I am also the chair of the National Association of School Psychologists LGBTQI2S Committee.
Thank you all so much for being here. And I want to start, Kathy, with a question for you. So our audience is mostly school psychologists or graduate students who are training to be school psychologists. And you've spoken openly in the past about Sam's disability. So could you speak about some of the experiences that you've navigated specifically in school for Sam, such as the evaluation process, the services he received, and if you felt that his needs were met in the school setting?
Absolutely. So as Sam has already said, very much an open book, right? Our family is an open book, his experiences. We believe that if by sharing our stories, other people are helped, that's fantastic. So Sam, having gotten lots of support from day one, from medical, mental health, you know, psychologist, all of that, was great. And when we brought him home from the hospital, he was part of our regional center, Hope Infant program specifically. So we had professionals coming into the home, coaching me on how to help him best. And then when he hit school age, that all changed. He no longer qualified for regional center. And they sent us to the district to have him assessed and tested, and then they would figure out what they could do for him. And it was a night and day experience for me. At Regional Center, everything just flowed and was easy, and people were there and really supported us. And then we had this very young child that I had to fight like crazy just to get what I think of minuscule supports. And folks that, you know, were much more educated in things like kids on the autism spectrum, but folks who really didn't have any understanding of what fetal alcohol syndrome looks like. And there's actually more people with FAS than there is on the autism spectrum. So that's a piece that, like, the educational piece around this disability is big. But, you know, getting him evaluated was a challenge. And then once he was evaluated, you know, they only wanted to offer the minimal accommodations And every year fighting, you know, then the 3-year triennials that came around and, you know, the time frame. I'll just, as a parent, I know there's lots of parents out there that will agree with this, the time frame at which when they say, okay, the triennial is coming up, here's the date, this is when it has to be, you know, finished by, was unreasonable for someone who has a disability and might need a lot more time to accomplish those things than what they gave him, right? So I just felt like it was, once we left Regional Center, it was like we just had to fight for scraps for his entire education.
Yeah, that makes sense. And that sounds really challenging. And it makes sense. I understand that you started a business called Trans Family Support Services to help parents and gender diverse persons find needed resources. Can you kind of tie your story to what led you to creating this business and talk a little bit more about what tips you might have for other parents around advocating educationally for your child?
Yeah, absolutely. So, you know, from day one, advocating for Sam's needs became primary in my life. And, you know, when we adopted him, the doctors told us that they didn't think he would walk or talk at 2 months old. And, you know, here he is, a 20-year-old young man who's a third degree black belt, a competitive gymnast, like he got those things down, right? And so I knew that advocating, I knew that putting his needs front and center to make sure that we were doing what was necessary for him was going to be really important. When he started his transition, he was age 11 when he started his transition. And for us, I'll just very briefly share, he started having a lot of mental health issues around age 9. And as I was taking him to professionals and trying to figure out what was going on, he was depressed, he was anxious, he'd have hours long crying fits, didn't want to leave the house, tried to run away, harmed himself, all kinds of things. And everyone I would say, I think there's a gender issue here. And they'd say, no, it's just, he's confused. It's just because his brain that was damaged from the alcohol, like, no. And this was almost a decade ago. So there was not as much education in the professional field as there is now. So it's not that I like blame them. Nobody was blatantly not listening. But it caused him to be 2.5 years in this really deep, dark black hole, because nobody was figuring out what was going on. So once he did start his transition, I had done so much advocating around his disability that it was just a natural transition for me to advocate for his needs. Because again, a decade ago, we didn't have that many professionals that were really working with young children with gender dysphoria. And so as I was advocating for him, other parents were coming along and finding out and saying, hey, can you help me? I need to do this for my kid. And it was actually, I was sitting in a principal's office with a family trying to advocate for this kid to get a 504 plan who needed it because of his anxiety, because of his gender dysphoria. And I realized sitting in that principal's office that I held no power. I was just a family friend. And that's when I thought, okay, I need to have an organization. I need to have something that says this is what we do and the professionalism of it. And so that was over 6 years ago. We've worked with over 1,000 youth and their families across the country. And a big part of it is advocating for rights in schools. And, you know, there is a high prevalence of gender identity with kids on the spectrum. And so a lot of our kids either have 504s or IEPs. And the first thing I tell parents is find an advocate on the school campus. It doesn't have to be your kid's teacher. It might be their counselor. It might be a psychologist. It might be an assistant principal. But find the person on the campus who will help you to kind of navigate the system. Because I think that's just key. And hopefully that's the school psychologist. But it's not always going to be.
Absolutely. And thank you for sharing all that. Sam, we're also curious to hear about your experiences of school, if you can share what you're comfortable with.
Of course. Well, I was actually very, very lucky. My mother actually homeschooled me for the majority she homeschooled me through a charter school for the majority of my life. During the time when I was on campus and in smaller grouped classes, I did deal with the occasional bullying, the comments of Sam's a boy. No, Sam's a girl. And definitely just those little interactions throughout the day, just your mental health goes down very, very quickly. And it just got to a point where I didn't want to go to school anymore. And that's why I resumed homeschooling for a few years in the process of my transition to become more confident in my identity. So by the time I did go back to school, there was no question mark. It was Sam is a boy.
Yeah, that's great.
I want to add that I think that's a really important piece that a lot of our kids, you know, gender dysphoria becomes so debilitating. And when you're already, you know, if you already have an IEP, if you already have other learning disabilities and challenges that you're trying to overcome, and then you add this to it, it can become so overwhelming. So having that piece of, you know, now we've got virtual school, which is great, but schooling in an environment where the external pieces do not become overwhelming, the other students, the other teachers, so that our kids can get kind of some success under them, and then rolling them back into the mainstream of school and of classes.
Absolutely. Those small victories play such a big role. And, you know, it sounds like, Sam, you were able to get what you needed eventually, but it was kind of a long road to get there. Amy, I'm curious from what you're hearing so far, how you think Sam and Kathy's experiences too compare to other students and families that you've worked with.
I would say that unfortunately, some of their experiences are very commensurate and familiar with families that I've worked with. Whereas other students that I've worked directly with, I think they've had a better experience. And I think part of the difficulties is, as Kathy was alluding to, in terms of special education, there seems to be a focus on learning disabilities or on intellectual disabilities. And as prevalent as FAS is, school psychologists and schools don't often see that disorder. And then even within the FAS disability, there's a wide range in terms of how it can affect people. And I think as a result, people struggle with it, because sometimes in the educational arena, we try to fit people into boxes, and people don't fit into boxes. And so I think sometimes it's a matter of school psychologists and the educational teams having to figure out what box to check in order to get a student access to services. And then we find out what services and accommodations are needed. I think in terms of the difficulties with transition, and as Sam mentioned, being bullied before he was able to transition, and then when he was able to transition and be able to present to the world as the man that he is, it was easier and less discrimination was experienced. I think often in schools, not just in schools, I think in society, there's a misconception that gender identity and gender awareness is not possible for people with disabilities or for people with intellectual disabilities or autism. When the reality is, research consistently shows us that if you have the mental capacity of a toddler between the ages of 1 and 3, which most people do, looking at the normal curve, you have the ability to understand your gender. And I think the difficulty is that persons that are on the spectrum or who have some disabilities might have difficulties conveying how they feel and how they identify to someone else. And then unfortunately, the burden of proof is placed on that individual to prove to us who they are, when it should be our job as the professionals to do the due diligence in understanding who they are. There has been a lot of research and a lot of guidance documents recently that would not have been available earlier when Sam was transitioning, to help clinicians better understand how to word questions to get the answer they're looking for. Because one of the things we find with people on the spectrum, and it also could be people that have FAS and other similar disabilities, is if you're not asking the right question, you're not going to get the right answer. And so a lot of it is us learning professionally how to reword something so as to get the information we need in order to provide the support that people need and deserve.
Absolutely. Thank you, Amy. And Sam, you know, we've heard now about your gender journey, and Amy, you've talked a little bit too about intersectionality already. And as NASS, we are trying to be mindful and increasingly more mindful about intersectionality, because we know that many students are coming in with, you know, these different layers and identities, and we want to make sure that we are aware of all of the things at play for any student. So Sam, could you speak a little bit more about what school was like for you as someone who identifies as both trans and as having a disability?
I think definitely something that intersected both with my disability and my transition was when I started going to school. We said, you know, Sam has disability and I needed accommodations. They said, all right, we can do that. That's totally fine. And then we said, well, Sam's also trans and he needs to use the men's restroom and, you know, use the right pronouns. And they went, we're going to stop you right there. And they said, we'll do it. Sam, use the he'll use the bathroom, male's bathroom. That's totally fine. But under one condition, Sam's not allowed to talk about it. I couldn't mention the fact that I liked guys or that I was transitioning or that the reason that I wasn't paying attention in class was because I was having a really bad dysphoria day. They just very much swept that under the rug and just said, don't talk about it or we're going to have issues. And so that was really devastating for me because I had just gotten back into a social circle and I felt like I was keeping this huge secret from my peers and my friends. And I felt like I wasn't being completely authentic or completely myself. And that was something that I wanted to share, but I wasn't allowed to because the school I went to was a primarily conservative Christian charter school. And the principal was concerned about losing other students if they found out that they were going to school with a transgender kid like me.
I'm so sorry that I can only imagine that that was incredibly hard to feel like you had to hide a part of who you were and that you had to fight so hard for the services that you were allowed to have, much less the ones that it sounded like, you know, that you were permitted to have secretly, but having to hide, that sounds awful. I wanted to ask also, I mean, it sounds like the school kind of approached these different aspects separately as opposed to in an integrated way. And so I'm curious to hear from you, for both of you, Sam and Kathy, what you might have wished would have happened differently so that things would have been a little more cohesive and more supportive.
Well, I for me, I think that piece around that they were two separate identities, right? Not let's look at Sam as a whole, but okay, we can accommodate this piece, but we're not going to really accommodate this piece, right? And what Sam says, you know, is still, I mean, this happened, you know, 9 years ago. So we have come a long way, but it's still happening today in that, you know, administrators become very afraid of what other parents will say. Right. And so let's just not have this get out. And then I as the administrator won't have to deal with what other parents say. But yeah, just that piece of, you know, Sam suffers from manages anxiety and depression as part of FAS. And he manages anxiety and depression as a part of gender dysphoria. So you can't really separate those two anxieties or those two depressions because you don't know what the core issue is in the moment. So you have to look at it as a holistic view of the whole person and not the way in which they did it as separate.
Absolutely. That makes a lot of sense. Sam, I'm curious, on the flip side, you know, what was most helpful to you in school? What went well and felt supportive?
Probably the most, the upside part of it was having an EF, an educational facilitator, and some other teachers that were also at the school that were affirming of my identity. And they always took accommodations to if I needed more time with schoolwork, or if I didn't understand something, that I could always come in after class and say, hey, can you explain this to me? And always sort of giving me that extra time if I needed it.
Yeah, that makes sense. More kind of globally speaking, what do you wish that schools know about students with intersecting identities? And maybe speaking about your own journey in particular, but also I'm imagining other friends that you've met along the way that may have had similar experiences.
I definitely think, like we said earlier, that it's, you have the trans piece or the identity piece, and then you have the disability piece, and just comparing those two things as different when they intersect so much, and it's taking that in as a whole and not sort of saying, okay, your education is over here, but your identity is over here. And sort of remembering that when your mental health is being affected or your emotional health is being affected, that plays into how you do academically and how your grades and results at school are going to turn out, and sort of taking it hand in hand rather than putting it in two separate bags.
Absolutely. That makes a lot of sense. And I know Amy can reiterate, you know, as school psychologists, that's something that we are advocating for frequently, where, you know, we're trying to stress the importance of mental health and how necessary it is to have good mental health in order to be available for learning, and how those two things go hand in hand. Kathy, I wanted to ask you as well, what did you find was most helpful to you as a parent in regards to kind of the school process? And on the flip side, what was the least helpful?
So, you know, for us, the most helpful were those couple of teachers that were the real true advocates, and just dealing with them and not dealing with any of the other administration that kind of wanted to sweep part of Sam's identity under the rug. You know, in that meeting, when they told us, okay, but you can't say anything, I was like, but this is him. Like, this is such a big part of who he is. And in particular, at that moment in time, was such a big part of who he was. And part of FAS is this very concrete black and white thinking. And so, you know, we had to deal with his backlash of feeling like he was lying to people when he wasn't able to be authentic. So that piece was really hard. And I think that's going to lean into, you know, that piece of, for you know, in particular school counselors, but all school administration and staff, to believe kids when they tell us who they are. And this is what I see in my work, is that, you know, people will chalk it up to, like Sam, oh, they're confused, or, you know, they're just doing that because it's trendy, or it's some YouTube person, or their friend has transitioned, or whatever. And so that piece of, it doesn't cost you anything to believe this child and to use the name and pronouns they've asked. Costs nothing. And so why wouldn't we do it?
Absolutely. Kathy, is there anything that you wish you would have known when Sam was younger that you might be willing to share to both parents as well as school psychologists to kind of understand the parent perspective?
Well, first of all, I'd like to, I would have loved, as Amy said, for Sam to have been able to have the ability to tell us who he was at a younger age. He's known his entire life, but it took us 11 years to catch up to him, right? But I think that, you know, for school psychologists, that biggest piece is, don't look to a parent to tell you what you should be doing or how this should be handled. I see that so many times with, you know, admin and psychologists and teachers, like, okay, you know, we'll do the name and pronoun thing, but we're new to this and you need to tell us what we need to be doing. Well, the parent's new to it too. We're still deer in the headlights, right? We may have had the information for a week, maybe a month, maybe 2 months. And so, you know, not leaning on that family to be the ones to tell you, regardless of whether it's about gender identity or learning disability. I had that so many times with professionals. Well, I don't know anything about FAS, so you'll have to teach me. Well, no, you're the professional. Go out and get your own education, right? I'm a parent. Let me be the parent. You be the professional.
That makes a lot of sense. And that's something that we talk about often when we're starting to do this EDI work with, you know, more emphasis is, it's so important not to burden individuals to educate you and to take that ownership for yourself, to educate yourself and to know more and to be better. So Amy, I want to shift back to you to kind of put this all in context for our school psychologists. In a perfect world, what would you like to see for gender diverse students in public schools?
I think in a perfect world, we would do what Kathy is saying and what Sam was wanting to say but couldn't, which is just see me and hear me and accept me as I am rather than questioning it. You know, when I'm training school psychologists, I say that when a student comes into your office and says, I think I'm depressed, your reaction is not, no, you can't be, and doubting them. And yet when it comes to gender and sexuality, we question it, and it's nonsensical because you're questioning someone else's identity and orientation when you have no knowledge of who they are. They've lived their entire life as who they are. I think something that we have to be mindful of is the difference between access and accommodation, because frequently I see schools saying that in order for a student to use the restroom of their choice, and that in and of itself bothers me because it's like you have to choose which restroom to use rather than just allowing the person to be their person. I don't choose to use the women's restroom. I just use the women's restroom, that kind of thing. But when we insinuate that there has to be an accommodation allowing such, accommodations are provided for disabilities. And an individual's gender is not a disability. It might be a difference. And it might be something that we have to be more conscientious of, but it's not a disabling condition. And when we say that we're going to provide the accommodation of using a certain restroom or the accommodation of using a pronoun and a quote unquote preferred name, to me, that's ludicrous because there is nothing we are doing to accommodate that person. We are simply allowing that person to access needed services and supports, as well as facilities in an existing building. And so it's about access, it's not about accommodation. I think one thing that school psychologists can do is just like Kathy mentioned, educate themselves. Don't rely on the person to educate you for them or educate you, yeah, for yourself, because it's your job, you are the professional. Where I think that you should not use education to circumvent a student's voice. And what I mean by that is, it doesn't matter how much you've read and how much you know about a certain topic, the individual is new to you. And so don't let research overpower what that student is saying, because that student's voice is what matters. And I think, you know, one small thing a school psychologist can do on the micro level is just listen to kids. And I think that applies to every situation because the student's experience is the student's experience. And regardless of what climate surveys say, regardless of what statistics say about the building, it's about that individual's experience. And listening to their story, just validating and affirming and trusting what they are telling you, has the ability to provide tremendous support. and then take that information and do something with it. Because one of the biggest frustrations kids and parents experience is they feel like you're giving them lip service if you are going, I see, that sounds really rough for you. And then nothing is done to address their concerns. So make a conscientious and concerted effort to do so and follow through on the things that you recognize to be things that can be done. But then also go back to that student and follow up to see if what we've done has made a difference. Because the truth of the matter is people are sometimes just guessing in terms of what they think they need in terms of support. And so if the support we're providing isn't actually support, it's not supportive and we should try something else. And so just be available and give credit to that student's voice because their voice matters more than ours.
Thanks, Amy. And finally, Amy, for those school psychologists who, you know, don't quite know where to start, but do want to educate themselves, are there any particular resources or websites that you might point to as a starting place?
I would point to our website, so the NASP LGBTQ page, and we are compiling resources, and there is all sorts of support in terms of connecting you to national organizations within the gender diversity arena, as well as sexuality and orientation, and educational and mental health resources. We are also in the process of revising our transgender position statement to support gender diverse youth, and that should be published within the next year. And it includes exactly what Kathy and Sam have said about hearing the person and providing access and validation to their voice. And I think that's extremely important.
Thank you. So this has been incredibly helpful. And I have to say, it's really nice to hear directly from a student and parent. So thank you, Kathy and Sam, for sharing your experiences and being so open with us. I am so appreciative of everyone participating on this episode. And to everyone listening, we also appreciate that you've taken an interest in these critical issues. We are looking forward to the rest of the series and hope you'll tune in for the next episode where we will be focusing more on the graduate school experience. For more information on EDI topics and social justice, please check out the NASP website. Thank you again, Sam, Kathy, and Amy.